Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to this podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Fall of Rome. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Today, I'll be joined by a fantastic guest. She's an editor for The Washington Post, a writer on Christianity and politics, and I have to say, one of the sharpest dang people I've ever had the pleasure of reading and listening to. Elizabeth Brunig, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So the topic of our discussion today is going to be something I have deeply, deeply neglected on this show, Christianity, or more specifically, St. Augustine. So before we get into it, a few brief words on Augustine to give you all some context. He was born in the year 354 in Thagaste, in what's now Algeria in North Africa, into a well-to-do family and received a fantastic education. So after teaching in Carthage for a while, he moved to Rome and then won a post as a teacher of rhetoric at the imperial court in Milan. It was in Milan that he converted to Christianity under the influence of the great bishop Ambrose of Milan, and in the aftermath, he began to write some incredible works of theology, including his Confessions, maybe the first autobiography as we would understand it. So his masterpiece, The City of God, came after the sack of Rome by the Visigoths in 410. And by that point, he was the bishop of the city of Hippo in Africa, where he died as the Vandals laid siege to the city in 430. So he was an incredible preacher, a theologian, a rhetorician, and even just a pure writer. And he's one of the foundational figures of Western Christianity. I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. So, Elizabeth, broadly speaking, why does Augustine matter?
So Augustine's a really, really interesting figure. He's considered among the foremost of the church doctors, the sort of foundational writers of Catholic doctrine. And he was an interesting guy aside from that. In terms of, you know, the way we think about Christianity today, Augustine obviously had a profound impact on that. He's one of those rare figures who's really beloved in the Catholic Church, but was also very, very well used by the reformers. So Luther was an Augustinian monk, Martin Luther was, and was very interested in Augustine himself. So Protestantism and Catholicism both heavily influenced by Augustine. And in terms of the way that we think about the self, about what kind of a thing a person is and what kind of interior lives we have and how they impact our reasoning and the way that we live, you know, a lot of the foundations were laid by Augustine there. Charles Taylor has this great book, Sources of the Self, where he's thinking about how we got the idea of the sort of reasoning, lively person that we now think of as just being, you know, the self. And he lays a lot of it at Augustine's feet. Augustine developed a theory of introspection that then, you know, has been popularized. And when we think about reading our internal lives and experiencing our internal lives as deep and vast and a place where we can go to understand our own motivations in a way that we don't on first glance, a lot of that was the work done by Augustine. He wrote a Confession. Some people consider that the first autobiography. And certainly, it might not be totally accurate. Few autobiographies probably are, but it's a very interesting spiritual autobiography. And he also, there's a great author named Brian Stock who argues that Augustine had a huge impact in how we read. He wrote over 5 million words in his lifetime. He was a very avid reader and writer, and he wrote about reading and you know, the way that he went about it was very discursive and very introspective. And he thought a lot about how to glean the most one possibly could from text. And so when we think about sort of critical reading today or reading deeply today, a lot of that can be traced back to Augustine.
Yeah, so it's not just Augustine as theologian, Augustine as religious thinker, Augustine as foundational figure in terms of the Christian experience. Also, things that you talked about, like interiority, the interior life of a person, the way that we think about that too, which can be in meaningful ways divorced from a spiritual context, can also be traced back to Augustine. That's really interesting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, there are some scholars who call Augustine the first medieval man, and he lived in late antiquity. And the reason they say that is because he played a really profound role in sort of translating, you can call it pagan or pre-Christian thought, from the ancient world into a context that would make sense in the Christianized Latin West. And in so doing, he ended up laying the foundation for just Western culture writ large in a lot of ways through, like you were saying, thinking about interiority, self, and reading and communicating. All of that was stuff Augustine wrote pretty profoundly on. You know, we'll get into it a little bit later, but he also helped smooth the transition from the ancient pre-Christian world into the age of the Christian Latin West. And so whether or not you're religious, Catholic, Protestant, or nothing at all, you have some contact with what Augustine gave the world.
Yeah, so let's build on that a little bit. What would you say are some of the key points of Augustine's thinking?
It's funny about Augustine is that people typically associate him with sex and with a pretty bad attitude toward it. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. Everybody has their own struggles in life. Augustine definitely liked the ladies. And I think all his life, though he did eventually give up that lifestyle, I don't think he ever stopped missing it. You can tell by his thinking and his writing, it was always an interest of his. And I think he was cognizant of that. He was aware of his own weaknesses. But that might explain why some of his most intense writing tends to center around sexual desire. So for that reason, and because he was responding to the pre-Christian world and a pre-Christian Roman view of Roman glory, and sort of throwing cold water all over it, Augustine often gets read as really gloomy, anti-fun, but I think he was really fun, actually. If you read him, there's a lot of mm-hmm. interesting little asides, and he had a very interesting inner life that he shared with the world. And I think that, you know, so when you start narrowing down key points, you can credit him with original sin, with the development of that doctrine in terms of how sin entered the world and, more importantly, how it's transmitted and then what that does to the human person. So the doctrine of original sin means that everyone is born bearing the original sin of Adam and Eve, which means that your will isn't perfect, and it tends towards error and evil, and it's not perfectible by your own means. So because people can't just perfect themselves, they have to be perfected in some other way, and Augustine went a long way towards very, very much spelling out and detailing the theory of grace, which is now a big part of the Christian faith, especially in Catholicism, that you can be healed of sin, and your will can be strengthened against future instances of sin through the grace of God, but not from something that comes from within, something that comes from without. And if that sounds a little bit Protestant, certainly the reformers took that thread up and emphasized it and exaggerated it to really build out that way of thinking about justification and salvation. So, you know, you can credit Augustine with having at least given the reformers some of the language that led to the Protestant Reformation.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, because Augustine's ideas on these topics were not the only ones that were running around at that period of time. There were other lines of thinking on this. How did Augustine's compare to those? I mean, would you have considered Augustine a radical at that point in terms of his views of grace and sin?
Well, Augustine held the party line. He was a convert to Christianity. He had been a Manichaean. He had been a Manichaean for many years. And he was eager to see the church become something solid and unified with a firm doctrinal line. Augustine liked coherence and he liked rules quite a lot. And coming from the ancient world, you can see how that was related to a lot of Roman legalistic thinking and ways of thinking about philosophy as being, you know, very detailed and oriented around certain facts and axioms. He was in the Platonic tradition. So that's where he was coming from. And he did hold the church line and in many ways helped solidify what would become church doctrine. I'm not sure I would call him a radical, at least not on these doctrinal grounds. He was pushing back against Pelagius. Pelagius, not really sure where he was from. He was insulted in his lifetime by being accused of being from Scotland. Some people thought he was from Britain. Augustine was no fan of his, though he never called him anything other than a saintly and honorable man. And Pelagius was very much steeped in pre-Christian philosophy, and he thought that people could perfect themselves just through strengthening their wills and focusing and contemplating. So people didn't really need Jesus to be saved. In fact, Pelagius claimed there were people who were saved before Jesus just by nature of their own virtuous lives. Augustine vehemently disagreed. He wrote lots and lots and lots of tractates against Pelagius, and the church took Augustine's side. But you're right. I mean, there were competing views and there were lots of gaps. So a lot of what Augustine did in terms of pushing back against Pelagius was to fill in gaps and to really thoroughly explain how grace worked, how original sin worked. You know, these ideas had been floating around in Christian discourse for the past 400 years or so, but he really filled them out and made them formal doctrines and gave to the medieval church what would be a more codified way of thinking about doctrine and a coherent Christian logic.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point right there, is we have a tendency to retroject back onto the early days of Christianity, frankly, more coherence doctrinally than actually existed at that point. That it's important for all of us to remember that there were a lot of competing strands of thought going on here. There was a lot happening. There were a lot of different ways of thinking about things that were happening at once. And it's to Augustine, along with some others, but to Augustine in large part, that we owe this kind of codification and because he was making good arguments. Like, he was making arguments that people found convincing.
That's exactly right. I mean, and even today, Christians will tell you, you know, our church is great. We're very close to, you know, the sort of original Christians. We're close to the early Christians. And all throughout the history of Christianity, you see Christians trying to get back to what the earliest Christians thought and practiced, because they think that's the most authentic Christianity's ever been. But early Christianity, as far as we can tell, was very fractured. If you read the New Testament today and you're asked to construct exactly how a church should work, it's actually kind of difficult. I mean, heaven knows what you would say if you took someone in isolation, gave them the New Testament, and say, okay, how do we make this a practicable thing? It's not really clear what somebody would come up with, because it's not really outlined there. So Augustine was in a world where there were lots of competing views, and he was trying to not only provide a codified answer to a lot of those questions, but he was trying to provide a way of thinking about scripture and about Jesus Christ and about the functioning church that would answer those questions going into the future. Because Augustine was very realistic, and he thought that over time, different questions and needs would arise. And there had to be an interior logic to the church that would allow the church to answer those questions. And so that is what we have in the Catholic Church today, and Augustine was deeply involved with that.
These days, I don't have as much time as I'd like to sit down with a good book. Luckily, Audible makes it possible for me to catch up with everything I want to read, thanks to its unmatched selection of audiobooks and other audio content. This week, I'm recommending A Distant Mirror, The Calamitous 14th Century by Barbara Tuchman. It's one of the great works of popular narrative history I've ever read, a deep and entertaining look at a disastrous century of famine, war, plague, and madness. Now, like me, you may not have much time to read, but whether you're driving the baby to daycare, walking the dog, hitting up the treadmill, you have time for an audiobook. Enjoy books in a whole new way. Listen anywhere, anytime. Try Audible for free by texting AUDIBLE to 28325. That's AUDIBLE, Audible, to 28325. One more time, try Audible for free by texting Audible to 28325.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Give Audible a try. If you like this show, you'll love what you find on Audible. I mean, I think you hit on some really important points right there. And this comes back to something you mentioned earlier as well. But one of the things that I've always loved about Augustine from the first time I read the Confessions all the way up to now is that he does seem to be living in the world. Like, he's really embedded in the world around him. He was a realistic person, as you mentioned. And everyday questions of faith and how to live in the world as a Christian were things that seemed to be very much on his mind. So, thinking about Augustine as a person in his world, his life spanned the beginnings of the disintegration of the Roman Empire and the Roman world more generally. I mean, how does Augustine's theological work, those concerns that he had, how did they grow out of the times through which he was living?
Right. So Augustine was very much a person who lived in the world. And you know, maybe more important than that, I mean, he was a monk for a time and he was a bishop. And he did live a different life than most ordinary Christians in that day, but he kept contact, with ordinary Christians. Being a bishop in Augustine's day and age was kind of like being a judge of a small claims court. It's not, maybe not the best thing for someone like Augustine, but he had to settle lots of disputes between ordinary Christians. So he was, well aware of their, ordinary lives. And in some of his sermons, you can see remarks that really let you know that Augustine was very involved in the daily mix of Christian life. I think in one, there was like a market going on and he could tell people were restless and he's like telling them to settle down. And so, you know, that's pretty fun. But in terms of the disintegration of Rome factoring in, it does factor into Augustine's theology quite a bit. And it's a huge part of the controversies he was party to in his lifetime. Augustine, one of his best known conflicts was contra the Donatists. So Augustine's born in 354, and about 50 years prior to his birth, you have the last great persecution of Christians under Diocletian. And that was sort of devastating for the church right before Augustine's birth. A lot of people just thought it wasn't worth it, and they surrendered. They either disowned Christianity altogether, or they pretended to have done so. And they were made to make certain public statements that they disowned the Christian faith. And Augustine was dealing with a church in his lifetime that was still kind of recovering from that persecution. And specifically, some of the people who had renounced the faith under the persecution of Diocletian were themselves priests. Well, as you can imagine, when the persecution ended in about, I think, 313, and Christians started to sort of regroup, a lot of Christians who had seen their priests and their brethren renounce the faith when they themselves had endured torture or lost family members or had been driven out of where they were living because they wouldn't renounce the faith, these Christians were not thrilled about letting those who had renounced the faith back in on good terms. And so a kind of radical splinter group emerged, and they were called the Donatists, and they were considered heretical. And they had a lot of, you know, kind of weird quirks, but they're pretty well explained by having lived through the persecution. So the Donatists would kind of commit like an early version of what sounds like suicide by cop. They would like aggress Roman guards and hope to be martyred. So you can see this is a culture, a group of people who have an intense fear of being martyred and have decided to cope with that by just kind of embracing it, even aggressively. And another feature of Donatist belief was that if you had renounced the faith, if you were an immoral Christian, then, and you were a priest, then the sacraments that you were celebrating didn't work. So if a priest who had renounced the faith, but then come back to the faith, and taken it up again, had again started performing, you know, baptisms or celebrating the Eucharist or something like that, the Donatists said, that doesn't work. None of those things count. And you need an actually virtuous priest to celebrate the sacraments so they can be efficacious. And you can see what's going on there. The Donatists had endured a lot during the persecution, and they had no interest in making nice with Christians who had renounced the faith. Augustine, on the other hand, saw the world differently. Now, he did come along after the persecution had ended, so he came from a different context. But in Augustine's view, and remember, he had been a non-Christian before and had kind of brushed off his mother, Monica, her attempts to convert him for a long time. So, you know, he had some experience with being a not virtuous person, to say the least. And his view the world was mostly composed of not virtuous people. He has kind of a diagram that he lays out of the very good, and those are like saints, and there are not many of them. The not very good, the non valde boni, and that's most people for Augustine. Almost everybody falls into that category of not very good. And then there's like the not very bad, and then there's the very bad. And he also doesn't think there's a whole lot of very bad people, though he thinks they're out there. But everybody's somewhere in that middle ground of being not so great. And so Augustine's view was, look, if God can't work through people who are not so great, he can hardly work through anybody. So it has to be the case that the sacraments are efficacious, even if a priest isn't perfect, because none of them are. And if you say that, a priest's immorality means the sacraments don't work, then you're basically saying no sacraments can ever work and that's not going to wash. So you're wrong. And that's a theological dispute that Augustine had, sort of directly related to the times. You can also see that the church taking that position, Augustine's position was the mainstream church position. The Donatists were heretics. That the church was ready to move on from this period of persecution that had characterized the tail end of Roman Christianity and to move into a period where Rome would embrace Christianity as sort of an official religion. Yeah. And Augustine's part of that transition.
Yeah, I mean, Augustine is kind of a big tent thinker in that regard, in a period of time where the church is trying to become more of a big tent. And groups like the Donatists, which stuck around for a long time, like there are still Donatists living under the Vandal kings at the beginning of the 6th century in North Africa. Like, the Donatists managed to maintain themselves as a coherent community for a long time, even amid a world where, like, the big tent has kind of won out, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And you can see how that would be the case, because the Donatists were advocating for a very hardcore, very invigorating, very inspirational Christianity, where, you can be a true, strong, virtuous Christian as defined against the weak and the failed and those who would renounce the faith and those who are too Roman in their sympathies. And Augustine says, absolutely not. It's time to step up and be a church that can bear the weight of being the Church of Rome. And that's going to mean bringing in lots of people who are not very good, who make mistakes. So this division in how you think about who you're going to count in and who you're going to count out has a lot to do with whether you want to be a church on the margins, a church of the excluded, or a church that is ready to take a position as the big deal, as the official, as the primary. And you can still see people having these debates today in politics, in any group.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting because, like, Augustine, in terms of this kind of big tent thinking, in terms of bringing people in, like, Augustine was mentored by Bishop Ambrose of Milan, who's, an utterly fascinating figure and one who doesn't get enough credit these days for his role in these things. Yeah. He's like a second-tier church father. But Ambrose was at the center of it all because he was in Milan. The imperial court was in Milan. He was at the very center of the intersection between religion and politics. How much of that kind of influence and that sense of being right in the thick of these really big debates about what kind of church is this going to be? What kind of empire is this going to be? How do we square empire and church together? Like, how much of that rubbed off on Augustine and on Augustine's thinking?
Quite a bit. Augustine went to Milan. That's where he was tutored by Ambrose. And he was very, very fond of Ambrose. He warns himself periodically against loving him too much because Ambrose is just pointing him towards God. But it's in Ambrose's company that Augustine made some pretty big changes in his life. A lot of people know Augustine had a legal concubine, as you know, that wasn't as salacious in Rome at that time as it sounds to us now, but he had a son with her and he banished her in Milan. Get lost. I don't want to do this anymore. He thought he was going to be marrying a sort of highborn Roman girl, but then decided against it and decided to turn to the church entirely. And so that's a pretty big change in Augustine's life, pretty impressive. And being in Ambrose's company made that possible. And I'm certain that being in Milan and around sort of political intrigue put Augustine in the mind of how do we steer the church through, these waters that could overtake it. We don't want the church just to become a political animal. Augustine himself was very political in his persecution. Well, he, people put it in different ways, but Augustine had his differences with the Donatists, and mm-hmm. he rallied Roman authorities to persecute them in lots of surviving letters, and they were persecuted. It made sense for the Romans to persecute the Donatists because the Donatists were strongly anti-Roman and were sort of a pest. And so the church coming around and saying, yes, let's get rid of these people was a big help, both from Augustine's point of view, because it eased the Romans off the church. If the church said our point of view, our official point of view is we're against these guys. And from the Romans' point of view, because it gave them sort of carte blanche to get rid of these kind of pesky protester types without looking like they were altogether anti-Christian in a time when more and more people were identifying as Christian. So it was sort of a match made in heaven there. And it didn't work out well for the Donatists. You point out they did hang around for a long time. They did. But their lives became significantly harder under Augustine, in part because he was willing to work with the Roman authorities to accomplish his goals.
Yeah, the great irony is that because the Vandals are probably what saved the Donatists, because the Vandals were Arian Christians, and so the Vandals were not especially interested in using any sort of apparatus of state power to persecute the Donatists when they themselves were a religious minority.
Right, right. And Augustine had his sights set on all kinds of heretics. The Donatists drew his ire. They were in his immediate area. They were a problem for him in North Africa. And so he focused heavily on them. He focused on the Pelagians, but he wrote against lots of heresies in his lifetime. And he helped develop a theory of how the church and state could interact. And, you know, you see his two cities, sort of metaphor, come out in City of God against the pagans, which is this big sort of magnum opus. And then you see that continue to be a part of Christianity for centuries. I mean, up until now. So, you know, Luther had his theory of the two kingdoms, which was heavily influenced by Augustine's two cities. The idea is received differently by Catholics and Protestants these days. But, you know, you can trace it all back to Augustine in terms of formulating a theory on how state authority and church authority should interact.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
So I'm glad you brought up City of God, because that, as you mentioned, that is kind of his magnum opus. And the direct inspiration for Augustine to write this was the sack of Rome by the Visigoths in 410. So the first time in 800 years that the city of Rome has fallen victim to a foreign invader. And there were understandably a lot of currents of doubt floating around at that point. Like, is this because we've abandoned the old gods? Like, and you can see that these are currents that it's not just Augustine who's responding to them. Like, Augustine's kind of less intelligent, less articulate sidekick, a guy named Orosius, writes a thing called The Seven Books of History Against the Pagans that's addressing substantively the same questions, but through the lens of kind of an interestingly put together history. Clearly, these currents are in the air. So how does Augustine go about answering these questions of, you know, is Christianity to blame for these ongoing calamities?
So Augustine's very intelligent. He's highly educated, and he's in touch with plenty of still pagan Roman aristocrats. And it comes to his attention that Christianity is being blamed for the sack of Rome. I mean, it's a big psychic shock And it's interesting that Christianity being credited with the fall of Rome is like still a theory that hangs around, much thanks to Gibbon. But Augustine was none too happy with that. And yet, unlike Gibbon, he was faced with Rome that was really crumbling. And so the psychological issue that you have to address there is sort of bigger and uglier than just kind of laying out an account. And so Augustine had to write something very impassioned, very intelligent, and very clever, but also pretty polemical. And that is where City of God comes from, City of God against the pagans. And what he's against is not only paganism writ large, but the pagan contention that turning away from the gods of Rome had caused the city to collapse. And, you know, his argument is that actually Rome was never good. It was never glorious. It's a very strong, very, very beautiful argument. And he says, you know, because morally it was always weak. And sometimes it takes a while for something that is morally weak or sort of rotten from the inside to break down. But Christianity says that cities can go and nations come and go, but the true glory is not achieved militarily. It's not achieved in the temporary things that you build or construct, but actually in the transcendent eternal life one achieves by loving God and turning towards eternal things. So it allows a Roman to kind of be at peace with the fact that things around them appear to be crumbling. These things are crumbling, yes, but they were always temporary because they're only earthly. And the true life, the eternal life, is yet ahead. It's not visible here. And it was always folly to conflate these temporary things with eternal things. So this was always bound to happen, sort of in other words. And that helped put it in a context that wasn't so alarming. No longer felt like the world was ending. It was just sort of trundling along. And then the other half of the argument Augustine articulates is that, you know, Christianity has a divine purpose in history, and it's going to fulfill that divine purpose. So you don't need to worry that things are going severely awry because God has a plan, has a knowledge of how all of this is going to play out. And City of God's a really big book. It's, I think, over 1,000 pages, and he gets into everything. It's sort of Augustine's theory of everything. But the local polemic is that, having to do with the fall of Rome not being the fault of Christianity, just being a feature of earthly civilizations and their temporariness.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to overstate how much he manages to get into the City of God, because isn't that where he makes like his arguments about just war and things like that?
Everything, just war. He has this really interesting theory of society as being like concentric circles. You start with the family and then get to the city, and then you have something like a nation, and you can think of them each being built out of smaller units, the fall of the angels. I mean, it's really whether the human body is made for utility or if it's made for beauty. He wonders. He firstly says strictly utility, and then he notices that men have nipples, and so it must be beauty.
Yeah, so he may have gotten a little bit off topic there with that.
It is an amazingly vast book. But it has an internal logic that's very coherent. And getting to see Augustine do that over and over again is informative for a reader. A reader can leave City of God understanding how to think like Augustine. So then you're going to receive new problems as different societies come and go, rise and fall. And in each era and epoch, Christians will be armed with this logic that allows them to extract the meaning from the problems that are facing them. And that's what makes Augustine such an eternal thinker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating to me because Augustine is so Roman in the way that he thinks about so many different things. Like you mentioned back at the very beginning, like the way that he draws kind of in terms of the coherence of his thought from like there are legal precedents for the way that he think for legalistic precedents mm-hmm. for the way that he thinks about things. Even the idea of the city of God, of two cities, of basing his kind of construction of society on a city-based model is an inherently Roman way of thinking about the world, right? That like that's because basically he's thinking how does civil administration work? Well, civil administration works from the point of view of a city, right? Like that this is all, it's so deeply embedded like a subway map in his mind.
Right, right. And there's tons of features of Augustine's thought that really resemble like Roman jurisprudence. And his thinking about property follows along those lines, for example. But, you know, in terms of the utility of Augustine's thinking for future thinkers, he's very flexible. He argues that scripture can have multiple meanings. There's no reason it can't. He argues that, you know, you really don't need a literal reading of scripture. And if new facts emerge in the sciences that contradict what's in scripture, that's not really a problem because there are certainly pieces of allegory and metaphor in scripture that are just as important. He's really interested in setting Christianity up for the long haul. And so it's certainly the case that him being a Roman and sort of a well-born Roman was a big factor in his thinking about the two cities. But when you look at its, you know, sort of late medieval incarnation in Luther, Luther goes with two kingdoms. Well, that makes perfect sense from the point of view of a late medieval person for whom cities weren't necessarily the biggest deal or the only game in town. And so it's very useful in that way, and it's definitely customizable for your own time. We might, you know, someone did it today, they might say two nations, two countries, something like that being our kind of unit.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. So reading Augustine today, what do you take from his work? I mean, or how would you think about Augustine applying to our world and our lives?
I think Augustine's very useful. In the United States, we are kind of in a position where Christianity in certain respects is a little bit on the wane. We have a circumstance with Christianity where certain features of Christian thought are embedded in the way that we think in a way that they weren't in pre-Christian Roman thought. And so Augustine never really got a chance to address, you know, what happens if you live in a place that is culturally Christian or kind of ambiently Christian, but is moving away from the facts of religion. And that's sort of the interesting question for me today, just watching the direction that everything is going in. But I still think Augustine's very useful. And for me, the most interesting aspect of his thinking is that he's not really a black and white kind of thinker. Augustine tends towards, you know, sort of both and type answers. He's a very nuanced thinker. And so he has a lot of very novel solutions to problems that Christianity had because he wasn't constrained by just saying yes or no. He would often say something sort of totally different. And I like that about his thinking. And, you know, in terms of principles that I pull out of Augustine again and again, the not very good ones is still very, very important. In terms of, you know, not only how we need to administrate the church, but how we need to think about the church's role in society and how to approach people who are not living in the way the church would ask them to. I think that Augustine's approach on that point is very useful. Say, well, you know, that's really nearly all of us. The church has to be prepared to speak to people who are not very good. Because if the church only speaks to people who are very good, there are several problems with that. One, it's not a big crowd. Two, it seems to imply that all you need is a kind of instruction or example, and then you can save yourself. But Augustine reminds us that's not the case. And at the end of the day, everybody's really in the same boat. We all need help, and we can help each other to a degree, but it's a merciful point of view. Pelagius is the hellfire and brimstone guy, although it doesn't instantly look like that. When you look at the debate, it looks like Augustine is the grim, kind of downcast guy, and Pelagius is the guy saying, hey, you can do it yourself. But you look around the world and you see what Augustine saw. Most people are not very good. So the best thing is to have a church and a type of theology and a way of thinking about the world that can find the good in people and can encourage them, but is not deluded about that. Because you're only going to end up disappointed otherwise.
Yeah, just the sheer breadth of his thought on so many different things. Like, you can read the Confessions and appreciate the beauty of his theological thought on a vast array of issues. Like, you can appreciate the beauty of his writing. And then at the same time, you read, this is my favorite anecdote that Augustine has in there, is the one about his friend who's obsessed with going to the arena and watching the blood sport.
Yeah.
And like, yeah. And that Augustine has in his mind, like, solutions for what do you do if you're addicted to blood sport? Like, he's got thoughts on that. Augustine has spent some time thinking about what do you do if you like watching violence too much? Like, that's, He's got some answers for you. I mean, I cannot recommend highly enough reading him, because even just his language, like, when you read the Confessions, it doesn't come through as much in English, but in Latin, like, he switches so fluidly from register to register, right? Like, he can speak in the most advanced, rhetorically sophisticated Latin possible, and then on the on the turn of a dime, he can switch to this, like, deeply spiritual language, and you feel like it's drawn directly from the Latin Bible. You know, like, you can see just turn on a dime this so fast, like, the shift in rhetorical mode and thinking.
And also, there's a poet. I mean, we don't have, except a few verses, I think, of his poetry survive. But that was certainly a capability of his. He has that in those famous lines. So why do you mean so much to me? Give me words to explain. Why do you mean so much to me? Whisper into my heart. I'm here to save you. I mean, it's an extraordinary expression of Christian love. And again, you can certainly see how, you know, Luther and other reformers receiving him in the Middle Ages must have said to themselves, you know, what do we need this bulky intercession of a church for? Isn't it enough to just love God? Look at Augustine. He was mad for God. And that's amazing. And that's what makes it such an enduring piece of theology. On the other hand, like you said, he's a funny guy. He's like very funny. He has thoughts about all his friends, sometimes like a little backhanded. He has a friend who loves going and seeing tragedies.
Mm-hmm.
And Augustine is concerned about that as well. But again, it's like he can get a reputation as being a little bit persnickety, you know, and he can sound sort of puritanical, but he wasn't. And he was very understanding at the end of the day. About the world that he lived in. And he's a good model for a Christian who has a deeply Christian life and an interior life that's very much oriented towards God, but can look out and see the beauty in the world as well. And I really love that about Augustine. I try to live up to that.
I think you've hit the most important thing about Augustine right there, that the ability to carry on that kind of interior relationship while at the same time, you don't have to reject the world to be a good Christian. You have to think about the world real hard from the perspective of the love of God and all of the kind of coherent theological thought, but like you don't have to abandon everything. That always seemed so striking to me in comparison with so many of his contemporaries who did retreat, who did kind of try to get away from the world. Like Saint Jerome strikes me as, you know, kind of the opposite of that. Like Saint Jerome was always trying to get away in a way that Augustine wasn't.
Yeah, absolutely. And they had letter exchanges that were kind of a little bit spicy, especially while Jerome was doing all that translation work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Augustine was not super thrilled about that. Augustine, some scholars think he was sort of weak in Greek, and he didn't have any Hebrew. Jerome did. But Augustine was worried about who would settle disputes over scripture if they were translated and had to go back to the Hebrew. And you can tell that part of that anxiety is, well, I can't enter the fray. And that's frustrating to me because I need to be able to understand the argument. He had a very active intellectual life and a very active spiritual life. But yeah, I don't see Augustine trying to run away from the world. He made a decisive turn away from things that were keeping him too attached to the world.
Mm-hmm.
He did do that. And I think that's part of what's going on in his, you know, sort of banishment of his concubine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can certainly see that and say, that's not a very Augustinian thing of you to do. Maybe you should have just married her, or something like that in the church or done something, you know, that was a little bit more merciful than just get lost. But it was something he felt he needed to do, knowing his own weaknesses. And I think that way of living Christian life, obviously, if you can avoid making impulsive, dramatic gestures like that, is very attractive because you get to be someone who thinks about culture and enjoys it and likes it. The only thing Augustine takes away from you is mindless enjoyment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing you can't have. And I still do it.
Well, that's a really good way of kind of summing him up, is that if you read Augustine and read him deeply and absorb the very real lessons that he has to teach, whether you're reading him in the 16th century or the 5th century or the 21st century, like it's hard to go back to looking at the world uncritically. Like it makes you think, whether you're reading him from a Christian perspective or not. Like he's almost Orwellian in the way that he breaks down the culture around him for you. You can't look at the arena and see just blood sport after you read Augustine talk about the arena.
Right. And part of the work he was doing there is constructing a Christian psychology, a way that Christians mm-hmm. would continue to think about the world up until now. And Augustine had a theory of mind. He had a theory of the way other people were thinking that was very complicated, very highly developed, and he goes into it pretty deeply. And that's been a lasting feature of Christian thought as well.
Yeah, Augustine, incredible. I feel like we've plumbed a lot of the depths here. I cannot thank you enough for joining me. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you and to talk about Augustine, this fascinating guy. Again, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I love the podcast. I love talking about Augustine. Thank you so much for having me on. It was great.
Oh, thank you for coming. And where can the people find you?
I'm on Twitter at ebrunig.
Okay, and we look for your writing in the Washington Post and your editing in the Washington Post as well, and the variety of other outlets. So thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.